This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day. The views and opinions of the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Political Review. My name is Quincy Parker, K. Quincy Parker, and I am your host for this lovely, lovely Sunday afternoon. Gorgeous day outside. Today is, going to be an interesting, fascinating day. I look forward to hearing from those of you who wish to text us with questions. But I only have a short while with the guest of honor, so I'm going to dive right in. Today we are excited to have as our guest. Have returned as our guest, the Honorable Fred Mitchell. Today is his first time with us as a senior cabinet minister in the Brave Davis administration. Mr. Mitchell, good afternoon and welcome to the new day.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Good here.
Yes, you are, of course, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. I suspect that was in the tea leaves that everyone was reading and the darts that everybody were throwing. That's where we all saw you going. But public service, was added back, I guess, to your portfolio. That is someplace that you also had, some experience. And I wanted to spend a few minutes with both of those areas today. I know you have a previous appointment, so I'm just going to just dive right in. I hope that's all right.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, all set.
Okay.
Got about an hour or so.
Yeah. Okay, great. So the you will, of course, have heard the talk in the marketplace about the report of the subcommittee on public service reform. That subcommittee is made up of Ed Fields, Dr. Nicolette Bethel, Dr. Yvette Pintard-Neary, and Ken Kerr. And they made a recommendation that could be considered radical. It could, I'll use their word. Their word is radical. And I wanted to sort of go through some of their underlying assumptions before asking you what your thoughts are on the recommendation that they made. Firstly, they believe that, the methodologies of traditional attempts at public service reform have not yielded the desired outcomes. I'm going to quote from the report occasionally here. It says, as a result, too many workers in the public service are underqualified and poorly trained. Further, because many of them were hired through political and other connections, their work ethic leaves much to be desired. In consequence of this, the public is poorly served, while the public service is inefficient and economically unsustainable. Given that this is your portfolio and your bailiwick to deal with, do you agree with that rather grim assessment?
I would say from a consuming point of view, or consumer's point of view, is that as persons who are receiving the service, that there are several complaints which would cause a commission of that kind to come to that conclusion. I'm not sure whether the empirical evidence actually bears that out. What I would say is that from a financial point of view, the liability which is upon the government that causes most concern is not really the salary as such, but the looming pension entitlement, which will have to be paid off at the end. And this, of course, is continuing to grow because it's an unfunded, it's a mandate, but unfunded mandate. Now, there was an earlier commission which was commissioned by the former Prime Minister, Perry Christie, headed, I believe, by Reverend Alfred Stewart, that had made the recommendation that it was necessary to change the non-contributory pension of the public service to a contributory pension. Had that situation changed when those recommendations were made, I think we would have been in a better financial position than we are today. Having said that, someone has to take the decision going forward whether or not to move to a contributory pension, and that, of course, is a very difficult thing. I just received a report last week on this. KPMG, I believe, has been commissioned by the government, the last government, to look at just that fact, and they gave their preliminary report. We're seeking to get the final report. So that is that. Now, I start with pensions because one of the reasons why, in my view, the government service is so popular as an employer is because, notwithstanding the fact that the salaries are not actually competitive in some areas, it's precisely that pension entitlement that causes people to say, this is a place I need to be. The salary is regular. It is steady. You can negotiate your loans with the bank more properly because it's regular and it's steady. And of course, at the end of the day, there's a pension. And as well, people forget that there's also the benefit of the free service at the public hospitals if you are a public servant. So costs drive many of the factors, but I don't think it's the actual qualifications as such that causes the service issues that the commission or those commissioners talked about.
Yeah, the recommendation really isn't founded on, when you read through it, isn't founded so much on qualification as it is on value for money, right? Are the services efficient? And are we getting bang for our buck, so to speak? And in terms of the actual solution that they propose, I'm going to read it carefully here. They say to assess, or they recommend, that we assess, this is a direct quote, assess the contribution of each public servant to the efficiency of the agency for which they work. And wherever that contribution falls below an agreed upon threshold, send them home with full pay.
I don't think that's going to happen. That's not practical. In fact, it seems to me that if you look at various agencies, people are under-resourced and not over-resourced. So I'm not sure that that is actually correct. I think that it's probably worth examining the report and matching up the numbers with what is actually delivered. When I was first public service minister, one of the things I couldn't understand, for example, is people not answering the phone at government agencies. And I said, well, I had one specific reform measure in mind, which is that on the second ring, the telephone would be answered by a human person. And I failed that job miserably. And I'm not sure why it is. But that continues to be an issue, is access. And of course, when you talk about specific places that deliver services, there's still the fact that people complain that the services are often slow, not predictable, not rational, not certain, not fair. And those are issues, of course, which any government has to seek to address. I suspect training is probably an issue. And I suspect also some numbers have to improve.
So you've mentioned a couple of times numbers in terms of I'm presuming research, empirical data on the public service itself, in order to drive decision making and that sort of thing. So the Economic Reform Committee, this subcommittee, would have conducted its research prior to making its recommendation, which even they say is a radical suggestion. So I think they acknowledge the radicality of that. Are you anticipating then, and you've mentioned KPMG, are you anticipating any more research into the public service, or has enough been done to give us a sense of what needs to happen?
Well, first of all, I want to see, review the report you're speaking about, and then see with some finality the report, which is done by KPMG. But I can just name a couple of instances. If you look at what's happening out on the high seas, if you look at the breaches of our borders, if you look at poaching, fishing, if you look at the height of crime, would you say that the number of officers that people these agencies actually match up with the demand? I think if you spoke to the Commissioner of Police, if you spoke to the Director of Immigration, you spoke to the Commodore of the Defense Force, I dare say he would say we're certainly under-resourced as far as that's concerned. So that's why I'm saying I'm not sure that to make a blanket statement that that we have too many people who are not qualified is in fact correct. I think we have to, you know, watch very carefully before we commit to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's, and I think any reasonable person would agree with us there. But I don't think that's the foundational principle for the recommendation. I think actually your first point about pension is actually the I guess you would call it the gorilla, the sleeping gorilla in the middle of the room, right? That you have billions upon billions of dollars now that are just floating out there, that you have it on a piece of paper. But, you know, when these people retire, in their scores and dozens and hundreds and then thousands, are we going to even be able to pay those pensions? That's a terrifying question.
Well, I mean, so far we have, but anyone looking at the metrics must be saying to themselves, is this sustainable at this current rate? For example, when we left office in 2017, there were approximately 3,500 public servants awaiting being put on the permanent and pensionable. So they were hired on the job, but had not migrated to permanent pensionable as they should after about a year or so on the job. Some people have been waiting as long as 20 years to be put on permanent pensionable. My suspicion is that one of the reasons that's not done is precisely because of this pension issue. Now, what is the solution to that? Clearly, for those who are already in the service, it is not possible, I think, without agreement from them, to change the terms and conditions of their employment. It is only possible for new employees coming into the service. But as soon as we saw that, then the cost begins to run down to zero. But it's been delayed, delayed, delayed. It's like, I think another recommendation made by a commission is that the retirement age should actually be increased from 65 to 67 in national insurance. Because that would be another way of delaying the demand for the monies, and people would be paying additional contributions to the National Insurance Fund. But just imagine if you had been able 20 years ago to implement a change for a contributory pension where the government puts some and the employee puts some. But that's an issue which the government has to make a political decision about, and it's a difficult one to make. It can only, I think, in my view, be done for new employees.
Mm-hmm. I am familiar with a situation in which a unionized group of employees would have agitated very strenuously against the implementation of a contributory portion or contributory pension for a portion of the employees when the others have a non-contributory pension. So I think that the difficulty of that fight is going to get that's going to be a major challenge between the government and the trade union movement as representatives for their bargaining units.
Well, I think we have a good discussion point with that, because a couple of things come to mind. One is that it may be that a contributory pension can be more generous than a non-contributory pension. And that might be a persuasive feature, even for some people who are already in the service, to say, okay, I want to go to that. Because at the moment, I think the cap is 2/3 of your highest salary if you've served the 40 years. You may want 100% of your salary. So would it be possible to migrate to such a program of 100% of your salary if, in fact, you could buy additional benefits? That's for those people who are on the permanent pension already. Certainly for hiring new people, that's a condition you can impose. The third thing is you could also, in some instances, because younger employees are not interested in pension, they're interested in the cash now, it may be that those who come in on a contractual basis and get the gratuity would be the preferred way to go in terms of hiring the public service as opposed to on the permanent and pensionable. But these things require not the imposition of the government, clearly it requires a discussion and negotiation on it. But what is, as you call it, the gorilla in the room is the fact that there's this unsustainable cost in the long term of a pension demand for on the non-contributory pension.
Right. So I want to go back to the proposal from the ERC for just a few minutes. The proposal to send people home with full pay rests on, and it's the assumptions underlying the proposal that I want to discuss with you rather than the proposal itself, which rests on the assumption that not only are inefficient individuals not advancing the work of the public sector, but then they are actively impeding it, which starts from the proposition that if they were to be removed from active duty, processes would be handled more efficiently and the public needs would be met in less time. And that would increase productivity and its corollary, which is government revenue. So again, the argument here is not, that they are, the service is poorly trained. It doesn't speak to training at all, really. It speaks to efficiency, which I know goes back to training, but the ultimate foundation is where there are inefficient people, remove them from the system. If you want to redeploy them, I mean, I remember this redeployment is not a new concept. You've talked about it when Trivago Lang was the state minister with respect for public service. He talked about, quote unquote, balancing the public service, where you have departments that are, as you said, understaffed, you know, redeploy people from overstaffed departments and train them to carry on the duties. But in the context of efficiency, where you have 10, you've seen it, you've been in the ministries, you know, 10 people trying to do 3 people's work, there's an issue there. And how do you deal with that in a way that is palatable to the Davis administration now? If sending them home with full pay is a non-starter, then what do you do?
Training is clearly an issue. And as I say, doing the metrics to find out if what you suspect anecdotally is what is going on. But I mean, just from my initial observations, there is a high level of dissatisfaction amongst the employees of the public service on 2 bases. One is, it appears to me that the service is riven in half politically. One half PLP, the other half FNM. And each half blames the other for the fact that they can't get progress on the job. So even though the system in the United States is one where there is a political level and there is a public service level, in fact, in our country, that's what's morphed here. And so we have that issue. Immediately one side comes in, they say, these people are PLPs, so therefore nothing gets done for them. And then the other side accuses the PLP of doing the same thing when the PLP comes to office. So there's that. And then there's a high suspicion that no one is a neutral agent. So I found a lot of complaints based on that. The second issue is that the human resources element in the public service, I think, needs a lot more work and support. For example, there should be routine assessments and promotions and retirements as a result, promotions as a result of those retirements, and of course recruitment, which takes place out of every birth cohort to bring younger people into the service. That does not appear to have worked. When I came in 2002, I met a report from the Inter-American Development Bank that said that a mistake had been made by the then Ingram administration as a cost-saving measure, imposing a moratorium on hiring in the public service. So the result is a knowledge gap developed, and I saw it very clearly in the foreign ministry. So you had people at this level with 1 or 2 years service, no one in the middle, and then up at the top, people with a lot of experience, and they were retiring shortly. So there was a knowledge gap. So there was that mistake made. And then secondly, in that sort of second subset is the question of are people reviewed? Do their cases advance in a timely fashion? We in the Foreign Service decided to morph to a system where you have a separate Foreign Service and takes care of those promotions. That's not quite work because all of that work came to a halt when we lost office in 2017. Now it has to be restarted. The Public Service Commission, which is actually responsible, as is the Police Service Commission and the Judicial and Legal Services Commission for those various agencies, their work is often at a bottleneck because it just seems to me, looking at as minister, that there isn't enough support for their work. So the routine answer that an immigration officer who's been waiting, for example, since 2016, 2017, 2014, to simply become not a trainee immigration officer, but an immigration officer, simpliciter, it's the routine response is it's at the commission. It's at the commission. And the commission itself has files piled up to the roof, trying to review these things. Now, so one of the things we've come in to investigate is whether or not the Public Service Commission rules have to change so that, for example, in cases where someone is a trainee, after 12 months, if you've not found a reason to dismiss them while they're on probation, they automatically become an officer, to put an end to that. Now, remember, all of these things carry financial costs because, as I say, as you said, the other room is the pension, which has to be paid at the end. So there are financial implications to all of these decisions. But all of this is at a stage, I think, that requires discussion. It's a society that does not move very quickly. People don't understand the issues because they're arcane. And so, for example, my discussing you in this kind of forum this afternoon, I'm sure will invite all kinds of speculation about how what I feel and what I don't feel. But I'm really in the mode of a discussion point at this point. I'm not making any decisions about anything because we're just trying to discover what in fact exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do have the advantage of having sat in the chair before, but as you said, there have been intervening years in which other decisions were made. I guess I have to follow this little trail before I get back to my main questions. There is a fear in the public service, and I think maybe in the wider community, but certainly among some of the public servants that I've talked to about this, what came to be known under the Ingram administration as stop, review, and cancel.
Right.
The idea that projects or initiatives that have been moving forward will now come to a screeching halt because there's been a political change. And you know, you've said it in the House a million times, and a number of other people continue to yell it and scream it in the House. The government is continuous. But it doesn't seem that government is continuous beyond the fact that we have a government. You know, in the last 20 years, every 5 years, you're lurching to a halt as you've started something useful and productive and beneficial, because the next guy comes in and he's got his own agenda or she's got her own agenda, and they start running, and then they lurch to a halt because you got to finish what you started 5 years ago. Are we bound to continue in that cycle in the Davis administration to come?
I don't think so. And it was unfortunate. I said to Jasper Ward, who did the story that first was appeared on, I think it was on one of the Twitter sites or other. Unfortunately, perhaps I was inartful in the way I expressed what I was saying. I don't think that any lawful promotion, for example, can be reversed. So if the Public Service Commission has signed off on it, the Governor General's gazetted it, I don't see how you can lawfully reverse those. That's a fact. I mean, the once the law agencies. What you do have, though, is a series of, what we've discovered is a series of executive actions which were taken on the day of the election itself, or before, just the day before the election, in which there was an attempt to carry out certain functions which really should not have been done. Perhaps they too are lawful. And what I said was not that they are stopped. We just want to find out what happened. Because, of course, what happens is that an announcement could be made as a result of decisions of the Public Service Commission, which happened before we got to office. But they come out after we get to office, and then people say, oh, how could the PLP do this? And, of course, it's not us at all. So the first thing is you want to know what was actually done. And I think that's all that's happening here. Stop, review, and cancel is not a part of the PLP's mantra. I mean, we've seen how the damage has been done to this country with regard to it. But I would say that when you look, for example, at what happened in Grand Bahama and Bimini, as an example, three buildings were started in the 2012 to 2017 period. One was the government administration building in Bimini. Another was the government administration building in 8 Mile Rock. And the third was the Holmes Rock High School. 5 years after we left office, with those buildings partially completed, they're still not done. And you ask yourself, well, what could have impeded in four and a half years of that administration, they could not finish those buildings? So that we need to know the answers to that. And it's, I think it starts off with the view that your predecessors, everything you believe, the actual propaganda that your predecessors were crooked. We don't come into government with that. What we come into government is we have to understand what happens. We also know that the ship of state is like the ship in the ocean. You can't just put on the brakes and it stops. When you put on the brakes and the boat stops, it takes a long time to crank that boat up to get going again. We warned the last administration about this. He said, now look, our experience is from the time the cabinet makes a decision, let us say to build a building, it takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years before the first shovel gets in the ground. So if you fool around stopping something in year one of your administration, to get that cranked up takes another 2 years. And by that time, you're lost because you just can't get it done. And this crew, the last crew, found themselves in that position where they were desperately trying to get some project finished. And, of course, they ran out of time. I am going to do my...
Did they run out of time? Or did they run themselves out of time?
Well, whatever way you want to describe it, they ran out of time.
Right.
They ran out of time. I want to put the most benign, a complexion on it, but they ran out of time. And, you know, so we end up with the position we're in. One of the things I thought is that because the offices I now have do not require a learning curve for me, what is important is to pay attention to the political side of the administration, because it is not in the best interest of this country, I believe, for the government to change 5 years from now. And we have to do our utmost to ensure that we have a 10-year period of governance so people can see what that actually means. You had 10 years of Ingram, you had 25 years of Pinling, and you see how that contributed to the stability of the country. Now, we're a democratic country, so in 5 years, we've got to go back to the electorate. And what I want to make sure is that we are in good shape to go back to the electorate in 5 years.
I'm sorry. So to be clear, then, that means you'll be retaining your chairmanship of the party?
I can't say that because I haven't had that discussion with the leader of the party. But what I would say is that throughout the Caribbean, the chairman is in the cabinet. So it's not a unique feature. But, you know, that's not for me to decide. I've always said the chairman is an agent of the leader of the party. And so whatever is decided along with that. But even if I'm not the chairman of the party, my role, I think, is to provide that political advice to ensure continuity of the administration in 5 years' time.
Sure. I see that we need a break, producer, but I only have an hour with the minister, so I'm going to skip that break, and we'll take it when we run out of time with the Honorable Fred Mitchell. So the next thing that I want to look at with you is in the PLP's Blueprint for Change. On page 33, it kind of deals with the initial thoughts on the public service. And I kind of want to read through some of those things with you just to make sure that we understand what your party's agenda is with regard to the public service going forward. It's kind of lumped in with labor, but what it says here is, and I'm just going to read each bullet point and ask you about it. Reestablish harmonious tripartite relations between labor, employer, and government. That's a tall order.
It is, but as public service minister before, I had a monthly meeting with all the union heads and the staff associations at the public service department, and I've already started that the plans for that. I met with some of them last week, and of course we have a minister of state who's quite capable as well, and she will be on the day-to-day basis trying to deal with that to make sure that we're more than outing fires, but we can anticipate issues before they occur. The problem, of course, is the country's finances are in a particular state. And so many of the issues are financial in nature that have to be resolved. What I was heartened by in the conversations with the Prison Staff Association is they said, look, what we need is decisions. What we don't need is just silence, and we don't hear what's happening. Just tell us, you know, we're big people, adults, we can understand what the processes are, but let us know what is happening. And I pledge to do that.
Before I go back to public service, I found my brain working in strange ways, so I have to follow these little trails when they happen. But earlier you mentioned something that kind of triggered my question about experience. You talked about the fact that you sat in the chair, and so your position for you doesn't require a learning curve. I mean, you've been the Minister of Foreign Affairs before. You've been the Minister of the Public Service before. One of the things that I think most of us believe harmed the administration was the level of the wide level of inexperience of many of the members of Parliament and some of the cabinet ministers. And I mean, that's because a lot of inexperienced people got elected. And the same thing can be said in terms of parliamentary experience of the 33 seats that Brave Davis administration has won. A lot of these people are new to Parliament, and new to parliamentary action. And I noticed that there's, you know, you obviously, Mr. Davis talked about the reason for an extra large, well, what seems like an extra large cabinet is because he needs all hands on deck. But in terms of a learning curve and a lack of experience doing this, what is your level of concern given the inexperience of so many of your teammates?
Well, each of those people who emerged as candidates for the Progressive Liberal Party went through a course in government, short course, but a course nonetheless. And I hope it's a lesson which is retained by everyone. One is to not get carried away with your own propaganda and with hubris that you come to the job knowing what a public figure's role is. So you're not a mechanic, you're a policymaker. And I think once people keep that in perspective, I don't think you run into issues. The second thing is to also understand that we are in a government. We are in a political party. And those two factors mean that you have to act in concert together. So even though it may look, for example, on occasions that a minister is a principality in the sense that, you know, he says so-and-so is fired, in fact, or so-and-so must move on, or this policy or other must change, in fact, it is the government acting in concert together. And so a wise lesson for any politician is to make sure that the announcements and the decisions you make are broadly based and not narrowly based. And I think if you keep those general principles in check, you will do well. And there's no harm in giving a call to the prime minister, saying, I'm thinking about doing X, Y, and Z. What do you think? There's no harm in kicking it upstairs to the cabinet and saying, look, I want to go this direction. I want to go that direction. What do you think? And I think people will stay out of harm's way if that's a mechanism that you use.
You also, because you've had experience in the Senate as well, you can, I think, really answer this question for a lot of us, right? There is a distinct lack of understanding of how political parties govern with regard to the work of ministries and public agencies, right? So you have these power staffs like DPL and whatnot, and then you have a direct ministry, and you have a political party that comes in with an agenda, but there's a public service infrastructure that has to be taken into account. And so we all have been privy to any number of stories or even witnessed ourselves times when politicians forget that they are politicians and start thinking that they are either permanent secretaries or directors of government agencies. So how do you keep the difference first of all, what is the difference to you? And second, how do you keep that difference front and center in the mind of a new person flush with political power for the first time and the ability to, you know, make a policy decision with the stroke of a pen?
Well, let's give the example of the last administration where the Minister for National Security was a former police officer. Mistake. My view is mistake. Because he could not resist the temptation of trying to be commissioner of police. And all the grudges and all the, you know, bruises and scars, blows that cut him down and laid him out when he was minister, when he was a policeman, he took those grudges, he took those prejudices and took those experiences to his office. I think that did a disservice to the country. The person who is minister is a policymaker, so he can't run the police force. The commissioner of police runs the police force. What his role is as minister is to supply resources and to supply general policy directions about the direction of the particular agency. Of course, the commissioner of police is subject always to civilian authority, and so is the Commodore of Defense Force. That's why as soon as the prime minister comes back. Both the secretary of the cabinet, the commissioner of police are down at the airport. I once had the funny moment where Hubert Ingram and I were landing back in the country. He was prime minister at the time. And I looked out the window and I said to him, I see the commissioner of police is out here to greet you. And he said, yeah, if he wasn't, you better put your hands together and pray. So that told me right then that, you know, the commissioner of police is a very powerful individual, but there must always be the fact of obedience to civilian authority. So that's what I'm talking about. So that's just one example. But ministers have to resist getting into the mechanics of things and, you know, deal with the policy and the resources. The other thing, of course, they are is to inform the public because they're the salesperson, so to speak, of the policies and what is being done. So that I think draws the distinction, I hope.
Mm-hmm. And do you worry with such a big team that there will be those who lose their way? I mean, we look at the minister's administration. He took in a number of people who turned out to either not be his, not be team players or rebel for whatever reasons, as the case may be. One of them is your member for Golden Isles, who has his own history with Dr. Menace and the FNN.
Yeah. Well, first of all, a couple of observations you'd make from the history of the Bahamas is these large majorities are largely inherently unstable. So it's a neat hat trick for whoever's the prime minister to keep everybody together. Sir Lyndon Pinling was not able to do it. It's just inherently unstable. But what you do is you try your best. You can't avoid conflicts. You know, politics is a very high energy business and people have very strong views. And sometimes those strong views cause you to take particular stance. So just think of 1967. You win an election. It's majority rule. All of those powerful influences about change, historic change and all the rest of it. And yet within 2 years, the government broke up with half the cabinet going in the next direction. So that's us. But you get through 72. And then 72 to 77, what happens? You get a big majority again. Nine or so people were hived off in 77, and Pinling survived that. So, and then, you know, Ingram ran into issues in 2002 when Wells, Pierre DePuig, I think Arlington Butler, a number of people had decided that they had had enough. So they went into the 2002 general election with that. So Ingram, ministers' issues are not surprising, but it takes a very clever politician to keep things together. I think the present prime minister, the beauty of the present prime minister is the fact that he has a personality which is not overtly aggressive and is more inclusive. And so I think you'll find that that should not be an issue. But as I say, people should not be surprised because, you know, there'll be disappointments, I'm sure. It's early days, and I think supporters ought to be careful. It took 4.5 years to do this.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not talking about the supporters. I'm talking about you know your people, members.
The people who are in office are only reflective of what our supporters are as well. So there are high expectations about what the government can do. And it's going to take a great deal of patience. It'll be difficult, a difficult course, because, of course, we have financial issues which have to be addressed. But I'm satisfied you've got the right personality at the helm to try and keep everybody together.
All right, so back to the public service in the Blueprint for Change. You have you want to ensure that labor issues are addressed as a matter of importance, including but not limited to the nurses, junior doctors, and teachers.
We signed the Memorandum of Understanding, and it was implicit was this commitment to try and make sure that we settle all of these issues. I just got a note from the president of the union, the nurses union yesterday, to put her in touch with the Minister of Health. And I'm hoping that that works quite quickly, particularly because we need all hands on deck, particularly with regard to this pandemic.
Yeah, the next bullet point takes into account our earliest conversation today. The public service needs to be reinvented. We will develop policies to reform the public service and place civil servants in areas where their skill sets are most needed as we aim to revolutionize the Bahamas.
Yes, well, I learned the first time around that the most powerful ministry in the government is the Ministry of Finance. And unless the Ministry of Finance and the Public Service Ministry are on one page, you're not going to get reform. So we will be embarking on conversations with the Minister for Economic Affairs, with the Prime Minister, who's the Minister of Finance, and with the IFS and his structure to see how we can incentivize the public service to accomplish those objectives.
You've mentioned training a number of times. The commitment here is to develop a public service training program throughout government departments in customer service, technology, and specialized areas to provide efficiency in services. I know that training is the direction in which you're leaning. And yes, pension is certainly a gorilla in the room. But does this, there seems to be then, or maybe it's just me, but are you saying that the administration is reluctant to downsize the public service?
Well, I don't think that's on the table. That's, as a political fact, that's not on the table. So unless there's some crisis, some financial crisis of some kind, I think that's not on the table. Neither, in my view, would it be on the table to stop hiring. I don't think that that's a wise decision. As I said, the government made a mistake in the years 1992 to 2002 in a moratorium in hiring. That should not have happened because time goes on. And each birth cohort ought to have some group in the public service to keep it relevant to the times. So I don't think that's possible. People are preaching a little bit, in my view, too much doom and gloom over the finances. I think we've got a really competent man looking after that. That's Simon Wilson. And he and his people at the Ministry of Finance, I think, will resolve any financial issues. I don't think there's a need for doom and gloom myself on that.
And you've already mentioned, I think, the other points, commit to clearing a backlog of public service commission for employees who qualify for permanent and pensionable, reassess benefit packages for local government employees to align with that of government workers, for example, pension.
Yeah.
And this last one, I think, takes off on what you just said. Increase employment through expansion of technology platforms and a digital agenda.
One of the areas I think that has the potential for that, we're dissatisfied, as you know, at the state of the digital platforms and infrastructure in the Bahamas at the moment. We think that the telephone companies have not done an adequate job in supporting the infrastructure. Right now, calls are dropping. There's overcrowding. The quality of the sound is poor, but it appears that the companies are interested in selling cell phones as opposed to investing in the infrastructure. Maybe a generalization. So one of the things we talked about ourselves is the government investing in a nationwide fiber optic connectivity program across the seas. And the government owning that through a parastatal, as you described it, then renting space on it, because we need to get to 5G as quickly as possible. So that's one of the ideas. One of the ideas we have to try and deal with that digital thing. But in terms of the employment, the overflight system that we just signed on to, where we can now collecting the fees and we'll go on to manage our airspace. The estimate from one of our benefactors is that there's some 5,000 high-value jobs which are ultimately available in that. And I can assure you that going forward, we'll be testing that information to see whether or not we can move as quickly as possible to get people in the systems which and to work in those systems.
The creation of this is kind of a swing here, because I don't know how much longer I got, so I want to get to one or two.
It's just about 5 or so minutes.
All right. So, okay. Where is the Ministry of Marine Natural Resources, excuse me, and Environment? Which is
the Minister of State, Basil McIntosh. And they're preparing right now for COP, which is going to be in Glasgow in Scotland in November.
So the ministry's name is Environment, and you have a Minister of State for Natural Resources. Right. Okay.
That's right, yeah.
Because I didn't see that in the list, so I just wanted to make sure that there was something.
Well, you know, Vaughan Miller was the opposition spokesman on those issues, and it's good that he's retained that in government.
Mm-hmm. When do the first 100 days officially begin?
Well, we swore, and the Prime Minister was sworn in on the 18th of September. Mm-hmm. I guess you start counting from there because those are the first executive actions taken. And one of them, of course, you know, was to deal with this curfew, which was causing such an issue for the public. I think that's helped tremendously with commerce.
And under which ministry? Oh, it's a very interesting question. Under which ministry does local government fall?
The Ministry of Agriculture, Marine Resources, and Family Island Affairs. So Clay Sweeney is the Minister for Local Government.
Does that mean, since it's in the Family Island Affairs, does that mean that the administration is not minded to pursue local government for New Providence?
I can't say that, but, you know, these things have to be reviewed. I personally am for it, but more importantly, at this point, we got to have the existing local government elections. They've been put off too long, and it's time to get them back up and going.
Okay. All right. Man, you are, as usual, a great interview. I know you got to go. So I will forego my questions on foreign affairs until the next time we can get together.
Sure, happy to do so.
My last question for you, again, brought on just by something that you said earlier. Did Christie make any mistakes in your view as a prime minister?
I think all human beings make mistakes, so I can't say that. But I think that, you know, He got a bum rap in many respects, because some of the policies I used to be able to list them because when we were speaking on the stump, but you know, you got BAMSI, the University of the Bahamas, you've got Bahama, you've got national health insurance, all were done by him during the last 5 years. So, I mean, the facts speak for themselves. History will write much more kindly, I think, at the end of the day as to what he did contribute, to the country.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I was curious and you answered the question. So thank you very much.
All right.
Be safe and we'll talk again.
All right. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Honorable Fred Mitchell, Minister of Foreign Affairs and Public Service. We'll take that break now. And when we come back, I still want to go through the rest of this recommendation from the Economic Subcommittee, the Economic Reform Committee's Subcommittee on Public Service Reform. Because there's one or two things in there that I think are interesting. But we'll be right back after this break.
Cherish. In view of the global shortage of medical masks, the World Health Organization recommends that medical masks be prioritized for health workers, people who are sick, and their caregivers at home. In consideration of this, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends the use of cloth face masks by the public to slow the spread of COVID-19. In consultation with the Ministry of Health, the Prime Minister of the Bahamas has requested that Bahamians wear cloth face masks outside their homes. Such masks can be utilized in places such as grocery stores and pharmacies. These masks can function to reduce the transfer of respiratory droplets by the wearer. While cloth masks offer some protection, you are more protected if you follow the recommended preventative measures in addition to wearing the cloth mask. These measures include staying at home, practicing physical distancing at least 6 feet apart from others, washing your hands often for at least 20 seconds, and not touching your face. Our healthcare providers need personal protective equipment while caring for patients. It is important to allow them to have the resources they need to function properly. If the public use cloth face masks, this reduces the chance of having a shortage of medical masks for the healthcare workers. Masks should be used safely and properly. Let us protect ourselves and each other.
This message brought to you by Bahamas Ministry of Health in conjunction with Guardian Radio.
Loss of family members is very unfortunate.
In view of the global shortage of medical masks, the World Health Organization recommends that medical masks be prioritized for health workers, people who are sick, and their caregivers at home. In consideration of this, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends the use of cloth face masks by the public to slow the spread of COVID-19. In consultation with the Ministry of Health, the Prime Minister of the Bahamas has requested that Bahamians wear cloth face masks outside their homes. Such masks can be utilized in places such as grocery stores and pharmacies. These masks can function to reduce the transfer of respiratory droplets by the wearer. While cloth masks offer some protection, you are more protected if you follow the recommended preventative measures in addition to wearing the cloth mask. These measures include staying at home, practicing physical distancing at least 6 feet apart from others, washing your hands often for at least 20 seconds, and not touching your face. Our healthcare providers need personal protective equipment while caring for patients. It is important to allow them to have the resources they need to function properly. If the public use cloth face masks, this reduces the chance of having a shortage of medical masks for the healthcare workers. Masks should be used safely and properly. Let us protect ourselves and each other.
This message brought to you by Bahamas Ministry of Health in conjunction with Guardian Radio.
Loss of family members is very isolating, and people who have experienced loss appreciate when others have shared their grief. If you can't be there in person, go to the Nassau Guardian's website online at thenassauguardian.com and visit our obituary link. The Nassau Guardian's interactive obituary link allows you to read the funeral announcement, express condolences, or place photos on the online guestbook for one full year. Losing a loved one is painful, but that pain isn't the worst thing to happen. Friends, loved ones, colleagues, and neighbors who ignore the loss compound the pain. Should the bereaved family wish to place the obituary and photos on our obituary site, just contact the Guardian's Funeral Industry Partners or the Nassau Guardian. Remember, there isn't one magic right thing to say to someone experiencing loss that will make the loss less painful or easier to bear. The Nassau Guardian's obituary link, available online at thenassauguardian.com.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Political Review. My name is K. Quincy Parker, and we just had a few minutes to chat with the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Public Service, the Honorable Fred Mitchell, an old hand at politics, and one might call him a friend of the show. I would like to salute the purveyors of the delirium tremens, which is one of my favorite new Belgian ales, and I'm enjoying a wonderful delirium tremens right now as we dive back in to the report of the Subcommittee on Public Service Reform that was created by contributors including Ed Fields, Doctors Nicolette Bethel and Yvette Pintard-Nuri, and Mr. Ken Kerr. What? So sorry. He's got a piece of news on WhatsApp that I am going to have to deal with. All right, so the wise lights just named talked about they've made an interesting proposal to send the firstly to do a study and identify any public service worker who is either impeding efficiency or who is impeding the efficiency of their department, and to send those people home with full pay. It sounds like the government would be wasting money, but the argument that has been made is compelling, and as I've just heard with our conversation with Minister Fred Mitchell, the government will the Davis administration will want to examine the report of the subcommittee. But what Mitchell said that they want to see more than anything is the numbers. The numbers that underlie whatever proposals or recommendations have been made. And the idea of sending people home with full pay rests on, and I shared this with Minister Mitchell, the assumption that not only are those inefficient individuals not advancing the work of the public sector, but that they're also actively impeding that work. And the idea is that if they were to be removed from active duty, processes would be handled more efficiently, the public needs would be met in less time, which would increase productivity and government revenue. If you send them home with full pay after having determined that they are impeding the efficiency of public services, these people will have the opportunity, since you're sending them home with full pay, to retool and make a positive contribution to society. And it also provides a means of developing the institution of the public service through the allocation and deployment of financial, human, and material resources to meet changing development needs. The subcommittee is not proposing that this idea be implemented wholesale. What they are recommending is, or what they're proposing in any event, yes, is a pilot project designed to test the concepts and measure the outcomes so as to determine the viability of the application of this proposal. And they point out a couple of, I think, indisputable truths. Basically, that the COVID-19 pandemic has already created a petri dish in which we can study some of the elements, or we've already been through some of the elements of this proposal. Firstly, some people did work from home. Some people were sent home and did not work. Processes were streamlined without having to go through the usual bureaucratic review and approvals. Processes were digitized in record time. Goods and services were delivered to the citizens in record time. And most importantly, the government functioned under those conditions. So what the subcommittee is suggesting is that we develop pilot projects in three government agencies, and the findings of these projects will be used to draft a range of approaches to public service reform. One of the things that I wanted to share earlier was the idea of why this idea seems to be such a radical idea, right? In the introduction to the report, the subcommittee says that they've been released from the shackles of previous and traditional approaches to present concepts that may seem absurd to the traditionalist. And their position is that the methodologies of the traditionalists have not yielded the desired outcomes. And I think that they have a pretty strong point there. Because for all the talk about public service reform, we're still here talking about it. And we've heard what the new minister has to say. And we'll be watching to see how his views get translated into policy and how that policy proceeds. There's a concept of how the public service came to be the way that it is that underlies this report that I wonder if we would all accept or whether we would question the validity of the report's recommendations because we disagree with the underlying premise. And so I want to share that premise with you now, right? And in terms of public service reform being difficult politically, it is generally that we worry that without the ability, so we worry that the people who are in the public service who are impeding efficiency are doing so because they don't have, either they don't have the qualifications or they don't have the attitude to do any differently. When you look at the history of how the Bahamas' public service has come to be, the subcommittee points to an evolution, by which the public service was utilized as a means to offer newly independent citizens the opportunity to move from fields to the office in the space of a generation. And while this achieved much in the way of economic expansion in the short term, over time, it's resulted in a public service, a public sector labor force that's critically overstaffed, unproductive, inefficient, and an impediment to further economic activity and growth. The political fallout from public service reform is no doubt one of the reasons that this reform has yet to truly take place. Right? So the subcommittee's report says, and I quote, "It is safe to say that the bookends for public service reform are ensuring that on the one hand, a status quo of sorts is maintained, while on the other, politicians suffer as little political backlash as possible with respect to right-sizing, correct placement, and public sector expenditure stabilization and reduction." And the existing paradigm, according to Doctors Bethel and Pintard Neary and Messrs. Kerr and Fields, is that the existing paradigm is not sustainable economically, that the existing paradigm does not meet the needs of the public good, that the existing paradigm will result in austerity measures that will be its undoing by external forces. That's a grim view of the public service sector as it is. Is it accurate? Do you agree? Do you think it's right? I mean, I guess it is what it is, but I think that we've heard from the minister a very clear, and I think this is important, a very clear signaling that the PLP does not plan on downsizing the public service, nor does it plan on not hiring into the public service. Mitchell's very clear point is that the PLP takes the position that the issue is training, and that with the appropriate training regime, we will be able to maintain and improve the public. So, do you, having listened to the minister, do you buy it? Do you think that's the right strategy? because it's, on the one hand, you have the academic, professional, researched view that you can improve the public service by sending people home. And then on the other hand, you have the view of the, you have the view of the new government, which is the policy view that will prevail when it comes to how the public service is treated. That, that's all right. That's my daughter's guinea pigs in the background, in case you're wondering. Can you use a small pot? I want to use that.
The small stirring.
Oh, okay, fine. The government's position that they're not going to downsize or send people home. They're going to retrain and redeploy, or train and redeploy. And so it's almost as if we're looking at the same problem and seeing two different issues. And my concern is that we're going to solve, or at least attempt to solve, one issue and leave the other festering. And the festering of the unsolved issue may well detract from whatever gains you make from solving the issue that you do solve. So that is a concern. And I'm just hopeful that with the attitude towards research that has been identified, that the research will show that in addition to dealing with the pension, and in addition to training, there must indeed be some redeployment of personnel, because the consumer of the public service product is generally not pleased. I mean, sometimes you'll read on Facebook or you'll get a WhatsApp message about, you know, a wonderful experience that somebody had at a government agency. And some of the government agencies are making very clear strides, in improvement, of servicing the public. But we still have a ways to go in that regard. So while there should be training, yes. While they must deal with the pension question, yes, they must also deal with the question of efficiency. And that, I think, is going to be a little more touchy, because efficiency sounds a lot like downsizing, which the government has already committed not to doing. So the Economic Reform Committee's proposal to send the, and they call them extranumerary, which means the same thing as supernumerary, which means extraneous or not necessary. So the solution that they proposed is, as I say, to assess, and this is important, to assess the contribution of each public servant to the efficiency of the agency for which they work. And wherever that contribution falls below an agreed upon threshold, send them home with full pay. We talked about why, and here are some of the recommendations that the committee makes in terms of dealing with the reform that these pilot projects will initiate. Right. First, it's the recommendation is the reform of physical workspaces. I'm going to quote here. It says, it's long been recognized that the brick and mortar 9-to-5 model for both the private and public sector employee is obsolete. As such, our model recommends that employees be permitted or required to work from home as far as possible or practicable. The advantages offered by this recommendation include the reduction in the need for expensive office and extensive office space, which means a reduction in the cost for renting and maintenance. The workers can set their own hours and thereby be able to be present for their families, which reduces lost hours spent on school runs and the like. And productivity rise as opportunities for excessive socialization and the accompanying distractions can be removed or reduced. So the implication of this recommendation, and I'm going to quote the report here, is that attendance at work will no longer be adequate as the primary measure of value for the worker. Rather, it will have to be replaced with productivity. That means that evaluative instruments will have to be revised accordingly. Now, that, to me, is a recommendation that should be adopted regardless of the efficiency question. That is, and I'll just leave it there. I think that is something that we urgently need to do. We need to investigate why it hasn't been done yet, but we need to be doing it. Next, the second recommendation is digitization of government functions. Of course, the government is already engaged in digitization of its functions. And of course, and what the subcommittee recommends is that where the government's digitization efforts are in play, that they should be fast tracked. And I think, you know, they list some of the advantages of digitization, which I think are accepted: greater efficiencies, reduction of the temptations for corruption, swift delivery of services, savings to the government, and thereby increased revenue. The third recommendation is the one that I think the authors of the report anticipate the most backlash from. And it is the removal of the extranumerary workers from the working environment. Again, extranumerary meaning not necessary for the fulfillment of the function of the agency. So where workers are freed to work from home and are no longer required to report to a physical location as a condition of their employment, those people who are currently unproductive are likely to become even more so. Further, the expansion of digital services will, over time, reduce and change the labor requirements of public agencies. Our model recommends that those people, and this is a direct quote from the report, that those people who fall into those categories be retained on the government payroll as an incentive to keep them away from the working environment. Unquote. Now, of course, the authors of this report and this recommendation acknowledge immediately after making it that it's a drastic measure and that it is counterintuitive in many respects. But, and here is a big, big caveat. The recommendation acts upon a truth that the society has been, I don't know that I agree that we've been reluctant to tackle. Those of us who received government services are more than eager to tackle this problem or this truth. But I think that our governments, for the political reasons that have been laid out, have been reluctant to tackle it. I think I agree with that. And the fact that is the argument that many public servants are already being paid for their unproductivity. So, in short, we really don't lose anything by sending unproductive workers home with pay, benefits, and pension entitlement. Because they're already getting those things and not being productive to begin with. In terms of cost and benefit, In terms of cost and benefit, the folks who wrote the report acknowledge that it may not seem to make sense in the context of, you know, government savings. Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for smacking. It's just the doggone delirium tremens tastes so good. How does it try to? But you might also be hearing my daughter in the background. So in any event, the rebuttal to that objection is that the report does not proceed immediately from the perspective of reducing costs in the short term, but rather from the perspective of increasing productivity, efficiency, and revenue. And I encourage folks to find the report and read it, you know, thoroughly for yourselves, because it's important to at least have a perspective on public service reform. Huh? So you don't want the lobster to have extra for dinner?
It's
all right. So, ladies and gentlemen, daddy issues. So it's important to have at least a perspective on public service reform that comes from an angle of efficiency, so that as Minister Mitchell and the Davis administration try to earn a second term in office, that we are paying attention and attempting to keep some semblance of keeping their feet to the fire and judging objectively as they are going about enacting their policies. So the subcommittee says that the current government expenditure with respect to compensation will not grow but decrease over time. And that through implementing its proposal, you'll see an immediate increase in productivity and efficiency. And that the net results would probably be a decrease in overhead, an increase in the ease of doing business, a reduction in petty corruption, and an overall increase in revenue over the short term. Over the long term, however, and this is, I think, the argument that they are making for implementing these pilot projects, they say that the findings of a previous previous government manpower audit makes it likely that the majority of the persons who fall into the stay-at-home category will be 45 years of age or older and have a salary between $13,000 and $35,000. According to our proposal, and again, I'm quoting the report here, the long-term costs of maintaining the salaries of these people will decrease steadily over the next 20 years, leading up to retirement, and will decrease still more as these people transition from salary to pension. And they've made a couple of other proposals to offset the costs of those workers who are sent home. Those other proposals include early retirement packages with full pension in lieu of continued salary. That should be offered to those people who are within 5 years of retirement. That salaries and benefits be fixed. That is, no further eligibility for increases in salaries or benefits for those people who are sent home. And that retention of full pension, but a reduction of salaries be offered if these workers secure employment elsewhere. The other factors, well, not the other factors, some other factors that the report considers include that increased wages to those that are invited to stay, who are either promoted or take on increased workload, that would be funded from savings. And in addition, the commission recommends that any worker who's identified as falling in the sent home category be given a set of incentives to assist them in crafting their future careers, which may include access to BTVI and UB for personal upgrading, access to small business loans and other incentives under government economic deployment program, development programs, consideration for government contracts over the duration of their continued employment, and counseling to provide them with awareness of the mental and financial impact of their position as extranumerary. All of the above will result in substantial savings over the long time, as long as the temptation to fill these extranumerary positions with more unproductive workers is avoided. And ladies and gentlemen, here we finally come to the Achilles heel of this proposal. It doesn't matter how many unproductive workers you send home, if all you do is turn around and hire a bunch more. And that, I believe, is the concern that in sending people home, you're making space and to a politician, an empty desk looks like a job that I could give somebody in my constituency. And I think that that is going to be, even if this proposal were adopted wholesale, which given that we spoke to the Minister of Public Service, and his reaction was, no, we're not going to do that. Even if it were something that was going to be considered, the Achilles heel, I think, as I say, is the fact that it seems impossible for a political administration to consider having these extra numerary positions and simply not filling them. To quote from the report, this measure must be understood as the opportunity to right-size the public sector at the smallest political cost. New hires must meet the new criteria and must be justified by their contribution to growth and productivity. Further, it is imperative that public entitlements be overhauled to ensure that these people who achieve permanent and pensionable appointment are productive and efficient contributors to national growth. That's a challenge. That is a challenge. The report has a couple of sort of further remarks to it that we can look at. Ow, ladies and gentlemen, forgive me, but I gotta say, ow, kind of crap. One of the things that I think obviously comes to what? Oh, the texters. Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know if I said that you can text us. Obviously, we'd love to see your text messages. The number to text us is 422-4796. 422-4796. And this texter says, public sector reform sent home with full pay is long-term, as well as a practice done when contracted or paid off. The proposal assumes full employment in the society. No, I don't think that it does. I think that the proposal is not making any assumptions about the level of employment in the wider society. I think it's focused pretty exclusively on what's going on in the public service and how public servants are able to or unable, as the case may be, to deal with the job that they have in an efficient manner. I could be wrong, obviously. Stranger things have been known to happen. Yeah, so one of the other concerns of this proposal is that the public sector union leadership would be concerned about the reduction of numbers in the bargaining unit. So in order to address that, the committee recommends that union dues continue to be paid on the total of persons that remain in service and that are designated as extranumerary. The dues coming from the extranumerary workers would be earmarked to skill set training with continued training offered through government. Another concern that they acknowledge is that the general public would have serious questions about officially endorsing and paying public sector employees that do not work. So in order to address that, The communications measures would have to highlight that this is a finite measure. And they would have to highlight that the costs incurred will result in debt reduction and increase public sector expenditure revenue. Another concern is that the political sector might see the proposal as being wasteful and politically immoral. And the response of the Economic Reform Committee Subcommittee on Public Service Reform is, and I quote, "Every effort must be made to remind the political sector that this simply recognizes the waste and immorality inherent in the current system and takes steps to correct it," unquote. Next steps here, pilot programs in three agencies to gather empirical data, and at the UB and the Ministry of Public Service together facilitate the pilot programs. I suspect that given the change in government and given the statement and attitude of the minister, that this proposal is dead in the water, but it'll be interesting to see if there is any benefit to be derived from it in terms of potentially providing some guidance, some conceptual something. To assist in moving public service reform forward in a way that is real and in a way that allows Bahamians to allows Bahamians to get value for money from the public service. So it's something to keep an eye on. And with that, I thank you for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you again next week. We will have a new show. And, I'll tell you next week who we're talking to. But I'm looking forward to this one. It'll be fun. So thank you very much for joining us again. My name is Kate Quincy Parker. It's been a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and God bless. Producer, thank you. And thank you. Bye-bye.